Today's program was brought to you by Emmy Cheese, specialty cheese from Switzerland made with heart and passion. For more information, visit emmyusa.com. This week on Meetin' 3, we're exploring interactions from drug studies in a laboratory.
If this effect is as big as he's saying, somebody should have discovered this long before he did.
To global wisdom on avoiding hangovers.
Beber cerveza antes de tomar vino no previene los síntomas.
Bière sur vin et venant, vin sur bière et belle manière.
Beer before wine, you're going to be fine. Wine before beer, you're going to be queer.
To the novel recipes developed by an Indian-American family deep in the heart of Texas.
And then my mom's sort of coming to America and learning that white parents love to melt cheese on things to get their kids to eat it. She was like, this is genius.
Be sure to subscribe to Meetin' 3. That's M-E-A-T plus sign T-H-R-E-E. Available wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hello, this is Dana Callan, and you are listening to a special episode of Speaking Broadly. Each week, I interview an extraordinary woman on her path to success, the victories and the challenges, things that can inspire all of us. Today, I am at Paws Up Resort in Montana with a fly fishing expert, a spectacular baker, a woman with a cookbook in the works. It is the great and one and only Kelly Fields. Hey, Kelly.
Hello. It's a lot of pressure.
I guess I should have made it like a lot more modest.
No, fly fishing expert is sort of, you know.
That's a good place to start,
first.
Right?
Yeah, that feels good.
I did put that first.
You did.
That's because we're in Montana, and I just saw that picture of you, the huge smile with, it looked like a speckled trout. How'd I do?
Pretty good.
Yeah? What brown was it, trout. Actually? It was a brown trout.
Yeah, brown trout.
Okay. So Kelly is actually not best known for her fishing prowess. She's best known as a pastry chef and for her restaurant in New Orleans called Willa Jean. And if you've ever had her pastry, it is delectable and flaky and generous, and I'm not going to call you flaky, but I'm going to call you generous.
All right, I'll take that. I can be flaky. I can own that.
I'm inspired reading your story, thinking of all of the women you've paid tribute to throughout your life and your career, and I want to start with your grandma.
Okay, that's a good place to start
because she's sassy and she doesn't cook.
Yeah, no, she was a terrible cook,
and I love that notion. I come from a long line of non cooks, so I kind of identify. Except I ended up
in
a different camp. Like,
sure.
You cook, I eat.
Yeah.
So tell me about your grandmother. And why she is like such a great inspiration.
So my grandmother was, my grandfather died when I was very young. I have very few memories of him. So she was always this single, sassy woman living alone, making it on her own. And she'd sit at the car. She was a like world renowned bridge player.
So okay.
She'd always sit at the kitchen table and just play cards and teach me to play cards. And she was a real smart ass. And like I saw that as a young child, especially to my dad, and I always really appreciated that about her.
Did it give you license to be a smart ass too?
100%. So even when she wasn't visiting and I still tried to be sort of sarcastic to my father, he would start calling me Willa Jean Jr. And so that was my nickname most of my life. Cause I get a little sass in me too. And if there's anywhere my personality comes from, it's from my grandmother. And so when I got older and I was in high school and having a lot of difficulty with my father in particular, you know, like coming out of the closet as a young kid and living in the Bible Belt and
that sounds
sort
really
of,
hard.
Yeah. Rebelling against everything that his ideals are. She was really like stepped in and was a champion for me and sort of like convinced my dad that I'm going to go do whatever I'm going to do and hopefully I'll be great at it. And that's his role is to only support me, which is what she did like to the very end and beyond. Actually, she still does.
And beyond. Do you feel her presence with you?
Yeah. Yeah, I
know. Like, in what way?
Especially when I was opening the restaurant, I felt like she was getting a real kick out of what was happening. I still giggle at the fact that if she were allowed to see my restaurant, and if she had known the name, she would have talked me out of it and told me it was the dumbest thing I could ever do.
Because it's named after her.
Yeah, so because she never wanted to be the center of attention. And she was never celebrated the way she deserved to be. And the first time since she passed away that the whole side of the family got together was like 2 days before I opened the restaurant. They came and I have this big, long family table in the middle of the restaurant, and they filled it and we fed them, and that was the first meal we ever served. So it was awesome.
What a beautiful way to begin.
Yeah.
Was she able to convince your father to be accepting of your choices, personal and otherwise?
I think it took her passing I don't think he understood how close we were. And when she got really sick, he made it up there before I was able. And he found all that, like, I wrote her letters like twice a week, and she wrote me letters, and she had like 34 messages saved on her answering machine, because those were those days. And I think 30 of them were from me, and he got it. And from the time of her passing to the time that I opened that restaurant, like, a lot of things shifted for us. So I wish he was here right now, actually.
Yeah. So, you wish he was here because?
Because I would like to go fishing with my dad.
Is that right?
Yes,
is that where your love of fishing comes from?
Well, I grew up in Charleston, so we lived on the water. So I went fishing almost every day. So fishing or crabbing or shrimping or something like that. Because I had to cook dinner for my family. That was one of my chores growing up. So.
And you had two siblings, and you each had that chore. It mm-hmm. seems like the chores were not distributed, like someone took out the garbage and somebody else made beds.
No, we rotated.
You all just made dinner.
Yeah, we rotated. So I would swap the cleaning for the cooking, because I always enjoyed it. And my sister in particular, I have an older sister, didn't enjoy it, and she was terrible at it. So I would switch with her, and then my younger brother would switch with me because I had switched with her, because that meant nobody had to eat whatever she attempted to make. So I cooked dinner most nights.
And I have this vision of you as a little kid mm-hmm. going and putting out your crab traps. I mean, was life as idyllic as that sounds, or were there complexities that doesn't even begin to touch?
I mean, a little bit of both. Like, I did not appreciate it until much, much later, until I realized, like, this was a job and I could pull from, especially when I opened Willa Jean and all of a sudden, like, savory food, like, what am I doing? Like, I don't know how to do that in a restaurant. And I pulled from that because I had actually been practicing my entire life without realizing it. But I look back at it as sort of idyllic. Like, there were a lot of complexities going on, but, In hindsight, it was really the best way to grow up.
And as we were saying at the beginning of the podcast, you learned a lot, because you have made the guides here jealous.
Yes.
With the number of fish you caught.
I've gotten very lucky.
Yeah. Your mother also seems to have been an inspiration, because mm-hmm. she was a great baker.
She still is a great baker. Yeah. She has more than one recipe on my menu at Willa Jean, and more than one recipe in my upcoming cookbook. My mom's whole side of the family were phenomenal bakers.
Do you think that it's, like, genetic? Is it in your fingers, this baking thing?
I think it's just an intuition you have or you don't. And I think you can learn it, but I've never been in the position where I had to, like, adapt myself. Like, it always just was something I did, so I don't know how one learns it.
Interesting. But you do know how to teach it. Today, we did a class with you, and I took so many notes. And this is random, and often on Speaking Broadly, we don't talk about cooking technique, but I'm just going to pause here because we were making, or you were making, a burrata and buttered crab tart with caviar on top. Mm-hmm. And people, just like, here's some really quick tips. There is such a thing as a perforated ring, so that if you are making a tart, you can put it inside the perforated ring, and then it toasts evenly. So I learned that today. Mm-hmm. I learned that if you want to make a tart, you should shave your cold butter and then put it in the freezer, mm-hmm. right? Why am I doing that?
Because you work the pie dough far less than you would if you were doing the whole biscuit method. Cutting in the butter is so much, it's just done.
Yeah. It's like chunks versus shavings. And that would be so much better for me because I kind of give up with the chunks.
Sure.
That was great. And then I learned that you're supposed to put vinegar with the flour.
You put vinegar in your pie dough at the end with the cold water or whatever liquid you're using, and it helps tenderize.
Okay. That was new to me. And I'm okay. So that was as you know, I have read hundreds of pie dough recipes, hundreds, and I've never learned that.
Yep.
In any case, so you're a great teacher,
and
your mom seems like she didn't need to teach you. So you just...
No, we just did.
Do you have any recollection of what the first thing you might have made?
No, my first real baking recollection was, we made cookies all the time, but my mom made carrot cake, and I had to be 7. And I ended up on the floor crying and screaming because vegetables don't go in cake. And so that's my first really vivid baking memory. And then how I was proven wrong once I got to taste it. And, that sort of opened up a whole world for me.
Do you believe in zucchini bread? How far do you go with
go
vegetables
in cake?
You go all the way.
Way. Yeah. I'll do anything. I'll try anything once.
A rutabaga?
Yeah, I've done turnip desserts with turnip cakes and coffee. It pairs really well with coffee, and I will try anything.
And were you sort of at your mother's apron strings baking with her? Was she?
Yeah. She baked every weekend, so let's say every third weekend, I would pay attention to what she was doing.
And what are the recipes of hers that are in the book?
In the book, she has a Mississippi mud cake that I remember she would make every other weekend, and she always stored cakes in the microwave because we never used it for anything else. So
it's better than shoes.
Yeah. And so I remember sneaking in and cutting little slivers all the time. And
so some people in my house, mm-hmm. We would be drinking the vodka and filling it with water. Mm-hmm. You're going and taking the mud.
No, we're sitting on the cake. Well, I was a very competitive swimmer all the way through school, and I spent 6 hours in the water every day. And so my diet was very watched by my swim coach and this and that. And Mississippi mud cake was not on that list of things approved. So I was always
sneaking. But the vegetables
sneaking.
In the carrot cake.
Yeah. We could get around it. But she makes a chocolate peanut butter custard pie that has a crust that mimics the icing of German chocolate cake, but it's buttery, and she puts it on top and toasts it, and my dad and I would get in literal fights, sneaking in the middle of the night to go steal that pie out of the fridge. So that's to me is the North Star of desserts.
Good to know.
Yeah.
So that's your, is it your hands down favorite?
Yeah. I've tried for 20 years to figure out how to make that the way my mom does.
Oh, what do you think is missing?
I don't, maybe just her making it, something always tastes better when somebody else makes it.
So. And then just continuing along the line of these inspiring women, you worked with Susan Spicer in New Orleans.
I
so
did.
You grew up in Charleston, but then you, at some point, moved to New Orleans.
I moved to New Orleans in 1996.
And so what were you doing with Susan?
Susan had, at that time, a business called Spice Inc. And so it was, way ahead of... It was the 90s, and it was this, gourmet shop at a bakery. It had a cheese shop. It had, barrels of olive oil, specialty olive oils. It was a place where you could buy cocoa nibs. in the 90s.
Wow.
That is... The Food Network was just sort of up and coming. And I remember I called to ask how to apply for a job, and she answered the phone at the spot. And I was just what's happening? It was mind blowing to me, but it's also exactly who she is. So she had a big classroom kitchen. She had a pastry shop. She had breads baked every day. So I started in pastry. And I would get to work at 3 a.m., do all the pastry, and then I had a real interest in bread. So at 1 in the afternoon, I'd switch over, clock out, and learn bread from the woman who happened to live across the street from me, just to learn it. So
Overachiever much?
Sometimes. Yeah.
And did she have a restaurant at that time?
She had Bayona.
She had Bayona. Okay. Mm-hmm. That was indeed so far ahead, because now when we talk about restaurants, everybody has like a cafe part and merch part. And
yeah, this was like 1998.
Wow. Yeah. And what do you feel like you learned the most from her? Because, I mean, it seems like you learned a lot just by observing, mm-hmm. but what did she teach you?
Well, she taught me to observe, and she sort of, that is the first professional kitchen I'd ever walked in, better yet worked in. And sort of the idea that like everybody around you is somebody you can learn from. Like she was learning from people. We were all exchanging information, and it wasn't this like tight, guarded, territorial sort of thing. It was like, here's everything we know. Like what you know makes me better. What I know makes you better. Like that sort of environment was like astounding to me.
And unusual to this day.
Surely.
Actually.
Surely. Yeah.
And not the course of things for...
Yeah, it's unlike anywhere I work between now and then.
Right. So. Except your own place where you strive for those goals. Like we've talked about it in the past. Yeah. That actually almost exactly describes mm-hmm. how you want to run your kitchen and your restaurant. Yep. So that's really interesting to me. And what was the bridge? Like, was there a time that you thought you would do something else and then you turned to food?
Yeah, I was studying chemistry. I thought I was going to go to med school. I made a friend in New Orleans whose parents owned a bakery and they needed help. So I went in to help them. And like I said, it was when this Food Network was coming up and this and that. And I fell in love with it immediately. Like that night I was like, this, I want to do this. Like people get paid to do this. I want to do it. And, my parents weren't as receptive as my grandmother was. My grandma's like, you found something you love, do it. Like do it.
So it's so great to have that person who then like lodges in your brain, telling you can do it, as opposed to your parents are like, well, I don't know. Mm-hmm. And do you know what you're doing? And I don't know. What were your parents saying to you?
I think they were just like most people. And like, that wasn't a career choice. That was like a default that you did to get to where you're going, or like how you paid your way through college, whatever that was. But it wasn't a career where you're going to make a like really good living and like get somewhere.
Right. And they came around.
Fine. Yeah. My mom did not take so long. My dad took a little bit longer. I don't think he really grasped what the food industry was at that point. And a couple of years, it was probably 6 years ago, he came to visit and I put him to work. And it was like the New Orleans Wine and Food Festival. And so I made him go work events with me. And he was just like it blew his mind. And now he gets it. Now he's wildly supportive.
What an interesting way to make someone understand mm-hmm. what your world really is, to make them come be by your side and, exist through it.
Yep.
And then Hurricane Katrina came through, and that knocked you off. Well, it knocked New Orleans on its mm-hmm. butt, and you left, and you went traveling.
I did. Well, I spent I spent some time in Asheville, sort of like getting my feet on the ground, figuring out what's happening. I ended up working as a pastry chef on the Biltmore Estate.
Oh, how beautiful!
It was a great property. It was a great.
I don't know how good the food is, but
recovery zone.
Yeah. Did it feel like that? Like, what did Katrina mean to you?
It was sort of. We didn't understand how bad it was until it was that bad. Mm. I was not going to evacuate. I left during the storm. And me, the guy that was my roommate at the time, like drove through it.
Wow.
And we
went. Were you scared?
Yeah, it was not a pleasant drive.
Yeah, it seems like I would be terrified.
It took us 16 hours to go almost 300 miles, just under 300 miles, to my uncle's house. And we thought we were going to like, stay there for 3 days and then we go home. And then we're going to go home. And then, the levee, we sat there and watched the levees break. And, we thought everything was fine. We woke up the next morning and we're like, oh.
Yeah.
And so where did we go after that? We went to Charleston. And then my mom had just moved up towards Asheville, North Carolina. So I went there and sort of reset and sort of figured out what's happening, what's going to happen, how long is it going to take, and what should I do?
And did you have any feeling like my
it's an opportunity, like I could change my life completely, or this is just terrifying, like, you know, everything I know is gone. Like, what was
it was back and forth between those two very things. It's like, oh, now I can go do whatever, like, what have I not done that I want to be doing in this, or like, but what am I going to do? And I ended up, you know, I stayed in Nashville for a little bit and then I started traveling and I went, my first trip was, I landed in Rome and worked my way all the way to Egypt and, you know, I had friends along the way I was visiting and, you know, that couchsurfing.com became a thing at that point. Oh. Wolfing was a thing at that, I think it's still
did you
a thing.
Wolf? Did you go into a farm and work at the farm? Mm-hmm.
Yep, I did that and just sort of meandered my way through and then I came home and packed my bags and moved to, I drove cross country to San Francisco. And
but what was it like? Like, I'm just curious because you had lived in the South pretty much your whole life, right? And you were close to family or close enough to family. Mm-hmm. And you really were doing something that you knew and loved. Mm-hmm. What was it like to be untethered?
I was still doing things that I knew and that I loved.
I see. So you were cooking all
and
along the way.
I was cooking, and whether that was in like a friend's restaurant or, you know, in somebody's house, and like the gift of sharing food and sharing cooking with people is absolutely universal, is what I learned. But I sort of thrive in solitude, and that's what I learned more than anything, is how much like being quiet and just sort of like, again, observing and like learning and seeing and, you know, tasting things that grow together in Israel that I would never see in the South. Like it's everything is learning.
And do you feel like that trip, it lodged in the back of your brain and it comes out at Willa Jean?
Sure. Yeah. It always sneaks in. Like all of the experiences like sneak in, like my time in New Zealand, like the food's really great in certain places, but like learning how to live in a van and like cook on the, you know, cook on a little burner in a windstorm, like you learn how to sort of like over, like I know how to do that in the restaurant, like if power goes out I can still cook, like just little things you never think about what you're learning or how you're going to use it in the future. Like that's what I love about it.
And you continue to travel, maybe not like to Egypt, but
no, not any time recently.
No,
I went to Paris last year, and the year before I went and spent 2 weeks in Iceland and lived in a van and cooked out of the back of the van and did the Ring Road. And there's a hidden ice cream, like an ice cream trail in Iceland, like certain barns. We'll talk about that later.
I'm ate all the ice cream. I didn't know that there was an ice cream trail.
Yeah.
A hidden ice cream trail?
Mm-hmm.
Because they have spectacular milk.
Spectacular.
And they have good ice.
Yep.
Being Iceland.
Mm-hmm.
What's this? Yeah. I mean, do they make a different kind of ice cream than?
No, it's just like you're literally eating ice cream with the cow that just gave you the milk. And it's just, I mean, you don't get that very many places.
And also you don't have someone going, oh my God, it's a single udder ice cream.
Yeah.
Right. But it is.
Thank God.
And you're like, oh, exactly. Thank God. It's not being marketed to me as a single udder.
It's only a matter of time, baby.
Udder ice cream. Yeah. And then you came in, and when you were in San Francisco, you worked with Shana Leiden?
Yeah, I went. So I looked up all these, you know, all the places there were to work in San Francisco, and Shuna was working on a new project that hadn't opened yet. And I sort of like I had been an Eggbeater reader. Her blog is Eggbeater. And really dove into her history. And like, she had the resume I wanted. Like, she had worked at Citizen Cake. She worked at the French Laundry. She opened Bouchon. She worked for Claudia at Gramercy Tavern.
Claudia Fleming, great pastry chef.
The best, literally the best. I love her. And so I naturally wanted to go work for her. And she, in our interview, said, you've been a pastry chef. Why do you want to work for anyone? And I was like, because I haven't been an employee and I need to know what that feels like. And she hired me on the spot. So.
And what did you mean when you said that?
Like, I had in every position, every job I'd had was propelled into some leadership role without the, I like really understanding or knowledge or guidance of what that meant, or the impact that you have on people. And I needed, and I sort of knew that I had a lot to learn in that because it's not something they teach you at culinary school. You don't even talk about it.
It seems like that needs to change if it hasn't already.
Yeah, it really does. And so I needed to understand what leadership looked like. And what, like, strong, like, strong, stubborn leadership look like in the best way. And Shuna is so disciplined and so precise and like maniacal about detail that like it was the hardest job I've ever had.
Because she's so demanding.
Yeah.
And you thought it was fair. So it made it even
better. Yeah. I mean, it made me question what I was doing and why I was doing it. And maybe should I be doing it? And maybe is there something else that would be easier or that I'd be better at? Or because she finds every little thing.
And I'm sure you felt like you're a lot better at the end.
Oh, 100%. Like the things that she taught me in our time working together still creep up. And I'm like, oh, that's what she meant by that. Or I'll say something and be like, oh, that was just Shuna. Like,
hey, Shuna, yeah, thanks for putting that in my brain there.
Exactly. I mean, she is a real inspiration. And the way she sees the world and the way she approaches food is so different than how I do. So, like, to even meet in the middle makes me, like, I hope a better pastry chef.
And how do you describe the differences between the two?
She's very wickedly smart and approaches food in a way that's really, really thoughtful and intentional. And like, here are the flavors I want to put on a plate. How are we going to do it? I'm more of a like, I can't think about food. I just need to get in the kitchen. Give me some things. I'll cook you something. And so to do that, and I also like concentrate only on like three, maybe four flavors in a thing. And she wants to really highlight and do a lot of things. And it took a lot of adjustment for me to learn what that looked like and how to even approach that.
And maybe even to appreciate it. Because
surely.
Although maybe at the time it brought up more questions in your own mind about maybe what I'm doing is too simple. Maybe it's not worthy. Mm-hmm. But of course,
I still do that in my mind.
Of course, it's the most worthy thing. Mm-hmm. In fact, all that simplicity.
Yeah.
Well, we're going to take a quick commercial break, and when we come back, we're going to talk about New Orleans.
Today's program was brought to you by Emmy Cheese, specialty cheese from Switzerland made with heart and passion. Since the early 1900s, Emmy has been a passionate supporter of farmers, cheesemakers, and family tradition. They believe in sustainable agriculture and respect for the people, land, and animals that make their business possible. Remaining dedicated to tradition, they strive to lead the industry in innovation, ensuring they bring you only the highest quality, best-tasting cheese from Switzerland. Emmy is best known for importing more than 80% of Swiss Gruyere into the United States, but that's not to overshadow their other specialty cheeses, including Kotbock cave-aged cheeses, Appenzeller, Tête de Moine, and traditional Emmentaler. For more information, visit emmyusa.com.
Are you enjoying this podcast? Heritage Radio Network has plenty more. My name is Sari Kamen.
And I'm Leah Kurtz. And together we host Food Without Borders here on HRN.
Immigrants make our food system vibrant, diverse, and delicious.
Each week, we invite a guest to talk about how food connects them to their past as we explore what it's like to be an immigrant in the U.S. today.
You can find Food Without Borders wherever you listen to podcasts and on heritageradionetwork.org.
Welcome back. This is Dana Cowan, and you are listening to Speaking Broadly, a special episode from Montana. I am in a treetop in a mountain in Montana. And joining me today is Kelly Fields, extraordinary chef, pastry chef, and the owner of Willa Jean, which is a restaurant that you absolutely have to go to in New Orleans. We were just talking about all the things that you learned from Shuna. Is that how she pronounced
Shuna,
it? Yeah. Shuna. It's just so you guys know, it's S-H-U-N-A, which is why I mispronounced it. And so then you were in San Francisco. You have no fear of moving, apparently.
No. whatsoever.
And is that, like, do you make friends easily? Does that solitude mean that you're kind of happy anywhere because you're happy with yourself?
Yeah, pretty much. I think I easily make friends. My friends are so dear to me. They're like few, but they're like quantity over quality.
I think the other way.
Quality over quantity.
Yeah, quality.
Yes. Okay.
You're going for quality first.
Yeah, that's what I was trying for.
Great A friends.
Yeah, my friends are the best friends, and but I can get along with most people, I think.
So, how long were you in San Francisco?
Almost 3 years. And there then, there was a period of time I spent in Edinburgh in between in the middle of that, in Scotland, learning about Scottish cuisine and their sort of farm to table movement. It's not really a movement; it's the way they've always been and the way they will always be, and how it makes us look like real idiots as Americans in our food system. And you know, I spent a lot of time over there just like in awe of how they live and how they eat and how they like approach food and care about food.
And do you bring that into your everyday today?
I try to, yeah.
And like, what does that mean aside from, you know, things that are fresh from the ground and probably not doing too much with them?
What's that? And it's also like using, like celebrating what's around you. And, you know, even at Willa Jean, I say we're celebrating the South as a sense of place without being, with really trying not to be cliche about it, because we celebrate like what we're able to get. And yeah, it's Southern food, or it's, you know, Creole, or there's a lot of low country influence from growing up in Charleston, but we're trying to highlight exactly what's come from right around us without like flexing any ego into it. And the Scottish are very good at that.
Huh. The no ego part.
Yeah.
What do you think the role of ego is in cooking?
I think it really depends on the chef. Like, I am blown away and swept off of my feet by chefs who demonstrate restraint more than anything. Like, it's something in the past couple of years I've really like noticed that I'm drawn to. And you know, chefs like Missy Robbins at Lilia is just like, her cooking is phenomenal, but her restraint is like mind-blowing.
And restraint in what way?
Like, she lets things be what they are and just ensures that anything she does to it just like gives it a brighter light to shine in. And it's like mind-blowing to me how wonderful that is.
And do you think that it comes from some essential confidence, like that, I mean, for whatever reason, like either the ingredients can speak for themselves or she doesn't want to talk over them?
Yes, both. Like, she, I mean, with her in particular, like, even just, like, you know, her vegetables at Missy.
I love her vegetables at Missy.
Like, yeah, I mean, even her vegetables at Lilia. I don't want to alienate one over the other. But, like, the artichoke. Like, there's not a more simple artichoke available.
Describe how it's prepared.
It's just, like, breadcrumbs, lemon juice, olive oil, salt. And it's just whole on a plate.
That's what I grew up with. And artichokes are one of my, like, you know, 15 favorite foods.
Yep.
And exactly that way. And I grew up with, I mean, just a boiled artichoke, but just kind of like that. Mm-hmm. She kicks it up a notch.
Yeah. She just cooks it as perfectly as the artichoke was when it was picked. Yeah. And just like every little detail is just simply and perfectly done. And I just, there's so much grace in that I'm in awe of her every time I eat at her restaurants.
So you came back to New Orleans at some point?
Yeah, I came back to New Orleans after I'd spent months in New Zealand, also again farming and picking fruits and doing horseback ride tours and whatever odd job I could get.
How do you feel about the like difference to you personally between doing the odd jobs and the sort of, you know, being in the back of a van and being responsible for like a team? And I mean, you've worked in, you know, big restaurant groups and now you have your own restaurant, which is smaller. There's such different mindsets. Yeah.
I find that I have regardless of where I am, I have a 3-year itch. Like every 3 years I have to go do something that's sort of like far removed from, you know, like Willa Jean. Like Willa Jean turned 3. I went to Iceland for 2 weeks and lived in a van and like didn't have cell phone, didn't have anything, and just like was there and sort of like recalibrated myself to who I am in the world and then go back and do it again.
And if you're recalibrating, what are you recalibrating from to, do you feel? Like what knocks you off center if something does?
I just think I feel myself like I get tense in every single way, like physically, mentally, like and I just get in this mode where I'm not really absorbing, or like I'm just trying to find solutions to everything that's going wrong or be proactive about things that I don't want to go wrong. And it's just like when I work really hard and I work like 100%. And I'm learning how to do that more, like draw the boundary more day by day. But every 3 years I have to sort of remove myself and like let it go. And then learn again, like, these are the things I can control. These are the things I'm wasting my time and my energy on. Like, and it's just a lot of like mental, like sort of like wash out.
It's great that you found a way to do that, right? Because mm-hmm. it's hard to do.
It is.
It's hard to come back clean. Yeah. You know, with a clear and open mind. Mm-hmm. And of course, it's a great thing to try to practice every day. But every day when you're walking in to your own restaurant and people are calling out sick and the walk-in's broken, the damn plumbing.
Yeah, plumbing, it's the air conditioner, everything.
Right.
The bread oven's on fire, like everything.
Those things just happen.
But I walk in every day and I always walk in the front door. And I'm like every day, I'm almost like the restaurant's almost 4 years old. And every day I'm surprised. I'm like, who are these people? They're coming, they're paying for food. Like, I mean, it's extraordinary. Like 4 years in, I'm still like, oh, what? Like every day it's like Christmas morning.
What a wonderful feeling to have. You worked for a time when you came back to New Orleans, you worked for a time with John Bash, who hired you as a pastry chef.
Yes.
Did he hire you to oversee all of his restaurants at first, or
No? So I started originally working at August in 2002 before the storm. So I worked for 3.5 years. The storm hit, and then I disappeared for 5 years or so, and I came back to August. And I came back to August because Michael Galata was the chef de cuisine at that time, and he wrote me an email, and I read it in New Zealand, and he's like, "I'm now the chef at August. This is what I want for it. I can't do it without you." And so Michael's like my brother. So I was like, okay, I'm just gonna like, I'll be there when I can be there. But like, I'm in the middle of doing something for me. And so I went back to August in like May of 2010 and sort of put all my time and attention to that. And in those 5 years, that restaurant group exploded and became giant. So I started, you know, helping this restaurant out, doing this menu. We're going to open this restaurant over here, write a menu, like hiring staff, writing menus, writing recipes, dialing everything in. I've been at every restaurant opening for that group. And so at one point I had 19 active dessert menus in the company and staff.
And had you written most of those?
Yeah, all of them. Pretty much all of them. There was one restaurant I was not responsible for.
That sounds like a lot of recipe development.
It is.
And a lot of training.
Yes. And
a lot of responsibility.
Thankfully, like the really cool thing about that job is we were opening restaurants in all the places I had been traveling since I started cooking. So like when, you know, we opened this restaurant and it's pulling from like when I spent time in, you know,
Israel, like Shia.
Yeah.
Does that count?
Yep. Yeah. So like Israel was still pretty fresh, and like that's an amazing, like their approach to food and their like whole diet, like it's really incredible. And like even how they approach dessert and like the, you know, not having anything sweet, really celebrating fruits and, you know, this and that, like to have that challenge, to be that creative on that scale with that many different personality chefs in kitchens that all ran differently, like I loved it. I really loved it. There were a couple of restaurants. I had my favorites, I'll say that.
And now you have one.
Yes, thank God.
But if you loved the 19, are there things you miss about being able to work on such a big scale?
No. Because Willie Jean is such a bigger scale than anything I could have ever conceptualized.
And it's all yours.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, that being a difference, right?
Yeah.
Because instead of doing a piece of the program, which is the pastry.
And now I'm like, well, do I need to make cookies or do I need to order high chairs or like, you know, like it is equal challenge to 19 menus.
Right. Because the business owner piece of it just is, it's enormous.
It's massive.
But you were working for John, who, you know, end up being thrown out of his restaurant group because of the Me Too movement and his actions. And did that send your life into chaos?
On a professional level, it did not. On a personal level, absolutely.
That's so interesting. I would have almost thought the reverse.
No, I mean, you know, in the articles, and, you know, in who I am as a professional and how I, like, developed that kitchen and, you know, learning from my own mistakes of watching and doing, Willa Jean was a bubble in the world of that restaurant group. And I feel like everybody knows that. And they did at the time. And my employees know that. And they felt really
protected by you.
Yeah. Not just protected, but like confident in who we are and mm-hmm. what we're doing and why we're doing it. But personally, it was, you know, it was a lot of emotional labor to figure out, like, where do I stand? What did I not see? What did I see and not realize that I saw? What could I have done? Like, the women that came forward were my friends. And, you know, we talked about stuff. And then it was a lot of, like, why wouldn't they have confided in me? You know, why, you know, or did they and I didn't, like, hear it? And sort of, you know, John's been, like, a brother to me for 20 years at that point. So even just, you know, going through the stages of grief, because that's what it was really difficult. And nobody teaches you or prepares you how to do that.
No, that... It was so above and beyond. And just to clarify for if you're listening, so Willa Jean was birthed within John's group, mm-hmm. but under Kelly's control, so she had control of that restaurant, but it was part and parcel of this larger group that was, you know, under fire, and where everyone's affected. Yep. You know, I mean, it's not like anyone gets to, like, talking about getting up and going to work and feeling good about it. Mm-hmm. You get up and go to work and you just have so many questions in your head. It's so cloudy.
Right.
You know?
Yeah. And we tried to be as transparent. I tried to be as transparent as I could with my own process with my cooks and my staff and sort of like, this is what's happening. Here's how I feel about it. This is where I am. This is why I'm talking about it or not talking about it. You guys are free to ask questions. You're free to talk. Like, whatever you guys need, I'm here for it.
And did people have a... I mean, did
some people did, yeah.
Yeah.
And, you know, a lot of, like, you know, if customers ask, what do we say? And da, 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 I'm like, I'm not giving you your opinion. Like, that's not my place. And so learning how to navigate that just as, you know, if people would ask, and very, very few people did because... You know, we did such a good job, I think, me and my team, branding that restaurant as something in and of itself that people very easily did not associate us with that behavior part of that. So.
And now it's been, how long has it been since?
Almost 2 years.
Almost 2 years, yeah. Really?
Yeah.
Wow. And when you look back at that time, are those feelings still fresh from...
Yeah, it's all fresh enough that I'm not reflective about it quite yet. I'm still like, it took so long to get forward moving conversations and forward moving action items and sort of figure it out that now, like, I'm focused, I'm looking forward, making it happen. And I'm sure there's a point where I'll be reflective on that time and what does it look like? How could it have been better? Like, all that stuff. But I'm not quite there yet.
And what's your feeling about the men who in our industry who have, you know, been pushed out of their businesses, but actually still profit from them? I mean, do you have an opinion about it from the industry perspective as opposed to, like, the personal
perspective? From an industry perspective, I think they should all divest, frankly. And I think it's really easy to say that from a public standpoint of not being, like, caught up in the nuances of, like, what's happening and what's accurate, what's not, like, what's just media being media, what's being, you know, picked up here and exaggerated. And you know, like not.
I'm sure you saw a lot of that because
like being in it, it's like a whole new perspective, and there's no way I can like tell you what that is or teach you how, like, without going through everything. And
I know that when you're inside of something, you actually know the facts, and then you see what's reported. Until you've had that experience, mm-hmm. you can't imagine. Yeah. I mean, although it's America today, so maybe you can imagine.
Yeah.
But in things that are seem more personal and smaller, how disparate the truth and the fact, the reports are.
Mm-hmm. And then, you know, like the things and the things that the general public or like the people that are reading sort of like latch onto and like, you know, the selectiveness of outrage from a public perspective is one of the most interesting things I've witnessed out of this whole thing.
And like, how would you describe that?
Like, I'm going to use April as a example. And, you know, we're talking about
April Bloomfield, who is a chef at the Spotted Pig, where Ken Friedman, was her business partner and was, again, part of Me Too and very clearly, had been abusive to the staff and, kicked out of his business.
Yeah. And so, you know, I think about her story and how it was, you know, paragraphs and paragraphs and paragraphs about Ken and his behavior. Mario was talked about and April was mentioned minimally, but April became the story. And, you know, I think about it and like, if I were in her shoes, which I kind of was, my name just doesn't happen to be April. So it was a much smaller shoe. What was her experience in that? And her experience since then, to me, says she was afraid of losing everything. And she was probably put in a position where that's exactly what she thought and knew would happen. And so now you have Ken Friedman, who continues to profit off of all these restaurants and, you know, build more and do whatever he's doing and have people come to his rescue, so to speak. And April has, in fact, like, lost her restaurants and, you know, lost a tremendous amount of money in trying to legally separate herself. And she lost everything, exactly what she was afraid of, while he is still there. And the attacks on April, I never worked with her and she and I have never really talked about it. I'm sure she in herself feels like she could have done more, should have done more. Like, I feel the same way. And, you know, I'm not in her position, but, you know, the fact that people aren't attacking Ken Friedman the way that they attacked April, and they choose to be outraged that a woman didn't help versus being outraged that a woman should have been in the position to help. It's a real challenge for me to sort of navigate that and like how I feel about it and how I would deal with it. And it takes up a lot of my brain.
Well, I can also imagine, because you're comparing shoe sizes,
yeah.
but in some ways, you are in, she, April, is in a more similar situation to where you were than probably anyone else you will ever know.
Yep.
In a
I really hope that's true.
You know, right. That's in a very particular, specific point in time. And because of the way your business was set up, your ability to move forward and look forward was stronger. That's a bad sentence.
I mean, tremendous number of mistakes to learn from, to sort of, you know, learn what not to do and what leadership shouldn't look like. And, you know, going and working for Shuna and coming back and sort of like starting to see the culture for what it was and understand like what impact that made on me and the people working for me. And my ability to sort of like pivot into creating a space that I thought that the restaurant should be. And, you know, that came with a lot of work and a lot of self-work and a lot of therapy and a lot of, you know, brainstorming with people much smarter than I'll ever be about can you do it? What does it look like? And how does it sustain itself? Because even at Willa Jean, we go into sort of like survival mode sometimes because we're so busy and short-staffed and everybody's calling out or this happened or that happened. And we like the natural instinct is to go back to that. And we fight it. Like we've been fighting it the last couple of weeks because we've been so incredibly busy.
So you don't have time potentially to take the care or to with the team.
Right.
What do you feel like the leadership lessons, because now you've had some things you really don't want to be. You've had some things of what you really admire, and you've had your own experience now. Like when you weave together those three things, where is it, like, what do you think the most important key to leadership is?
Transparency and communication.
Well, that was an easy answer.
Yeah, 100%. You know, like, you have to go through that time. Like, you have to earn respect, and that's always going to be a key of leadership. Like, I've seen, you know, chefs or cooks walk in the kitchen and just, like, demand it without, like, I will never, like, I am far less important to my business than my line cooks, than my dishwashers. Like, me being there or not doesn't affect the hostesses. Like, they are the impact of my business. They are the faces. They, like, they create the culture. They, you know, spread the gospel, Will Jean, if you will. And I don't act like, I don't behave like, I don't set the standard where I walk in and things should be different or that they should address me a certain way. I don't like to be called ma'am. We've dealt with that a couple times, but.
Oh, really? Because your team, because it's the South and people just call you ma'am.
Yeah. Because I worked in kitchens for 20 years where I was ma'am and not chef, even though I was the chef of the kitchen. And it drove me nuts. And so I decided to own it and name my foundation Yes Ma'am. But
I didn't know that's where it came from.
Yeah, but I still don't like to be called it. But my presence or my role at Willa Jean is so less than the people doing the work.
I mean, I have to believe that is very self-effacing and not 100% true, right? Because you're the face of it. You are the direction and the vision and the recipes are yours. No. But what you're saying is you want to give them agency over their day and not 100%. Take it from them as if just because you do those things that they're not important.
Right.
So you're sharing the wealth.
No, but if they don't have to see my work, then I've done my job, is how I feel about it.
Right. So I've gotten to meet on this trip your best friend, or one of your best friends.
Yep.
You have a few, named Martine.
Yep.
Who is so double triple awesome.
Yeah, I agree.
And I want to know how someone who's as busy as you are, because you're just describing like you're so in it. Mm-hmm. How do you develop friendships that last when you have no time?
You make time. And that's like the boundaries and prioritizing, like that whole, like, you're not busy or you're not too busy to do it. You're not prioritizing in the right way is something I am sort of living and breathing lately. Martine and I met like 6 or 7 years ago, and she lived in San Francisco at the time. And so when she was in town, we'd just connect, and then, you know, we would text, or I would happen to go to San Francisco for something. So we'd meet up, and so like we just can drop in, and it doesn't matter if I haven't seen her in 3 days or 3 weeks or 3 months, because sometimes that happens. Like, we drop in right where we are.
I love it.
I do too.
Everyone should have a best friend like Martine.
Yeah.
I'm trying to learn from my guests, and so I'm going to ask you to teach me something.
Okay.
That's a good life skill, but it has to be in words because we can't show anybody on this.
Sure.
Podcast. Great. What's it going to be? What are you going to teach me?
A life skill.
Yeah.
Give me an example. Give me.
Priya Krishna taught me how to fold pants because her mother had worked at a store where she had to fold pants, and she taught the girls, her daughters, to fold pants. So Priya had to fold 100 pairs of pants. So I had her teach me how to fold pants. It's just this weird thing that I had learned and I knew she had done.
Sure.
And then I spoke with a horsewoman, and she taught me how to approach a horse, which is kind of extraordinary because it's really how you should approach a human. I mean, there's some specifics that are different, like you stare at its stomach, which I wouldn't stare at your stomach if I was approaching you. I try not to. But you know, her way of approaching, and there are steps. It's very much like a recipe. Huh. And so these are like little recipes for life that I'm collecting.
Okay.
But you could also teach me a recipe.
Oh, you do that enough. I am going to bring this full circle and teach you how to cast a fly fishing rod.
Amazing.
How about that?
I'm totally ready for
that.
Are
you right-handed or left-handed?
Left.
All right. Oh, that's interesting. you're going to... Let me think of how to put this into words. So the most important thing you do when you cast a fly rod is you don't break your wrist. So you have to keep it really stiff. It's all in your elbow. And the biggest lesson, the thing I fight with all the time, is the amount of time that you, when you bring your elbow up from your side up to the side of your head with the rod in it, you have to say a word at least as long as the word cheeseburger. Because you hold the rod in front of you, your elbow's at 90 degrees, you bring it up to your right beside your face, and you have to say the word cheeseburger because you have the line is coming behind you, and you have to give it the time to get behind you before you go forward back to 90 degrees.
That's an amazing lesson. And it included food.
Yeah.
So, that's awesome. Does. Thank you. And the last question of the show is, I always like to pay it forward to women who don't get as much acknowledgement in this community and the world at large. So is there a woman in our industry who you want to pay it forward to, who you believe to be should be better known, and why?
There's so many.
You can pick one, two.
So many. I'm going to pick Christina has Levy Baking in New Orleans. She has been doing a pop-up for a while. She just got a brick-and-mortar space. So she'll be opening on Magazine Street hopefully any day now. But she...
And what's the bakery called?
Levy.
Okay.
Like when the levees broke.
Got it.
Levy Baking Company. She hands down makes the best pastries in New Orleans, and I'll say that above myself. She's amazing.
And what
everybody should know her.
Okay, great. What type of pastry?
All of them. She does bread. She does a lot of like laminated doughs, and I mean, she's been doing it in a little tiny oven in shared space. Like, it's incredible what she's doing. Her pies are stunning. She did beautiful king cakes this year. She's phenomenal, and she's a phenomenal person also that's trying to do really good in this industry. On top of that, I would pick...
I wonder about the Cajun Caviar Ladies.
Oh, yeah. So Cajun Caviar Ladies, Amy Wilson owns Cajun Caviar. I think she has 3 women business partners. And so they make all the caviar in Louisiana, and they go out and get the... bowfin fish out of the bayous, and that's what they're using for their caviar.
It was great. It was really fun to taste. Talk about full circle, because I got to taste some of it last night here at Paws Up Resort in Montana. Well, thank you so much, Kelly, for joining me. This has been such an incredible pleasure. Thank you for taking the time away from all the things you could be doing here, from fishing to hiking to mountain biking to ATVing. And how can people find you on social?
I am Kelly Fields on Instagram, or Willa G New Orleans on everything. So,
and this is Dana Cowan. I'm so happy that you're listening. If you enjoy what you're hearing, go subscribe to Speaking Broadly on iTunes, Stitcher, or other places where podcasts can be found. And you know where to find me on social. I'm at Speaking Broadly. I hope you enjoyed the show, and I hope you enjoy your week.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to learn more about our 10-year anniversary celebration happening all year long, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork.
Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.